welcome to another Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Since 1998, DomesticPreparedness.com has published critical solutions for the professional preparedness community. Today's interview is sponsored by Scepter Industries. Scepter Industries produces aerosol collection technologies. The Omni 3000 portable aerosol collector for first responders and IAQ experts utilizes proven SpinCon technology. For more information, visit www.scepterindustries.com. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
Domestic Preparedness is at Fort Detrick near Frederick, Maryland, just northwest of Washington, D.C., and we're talking with Colonel George Korch, who's the commander of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, and that's known colloquially as USAMRID. Colonel Korch holds a Ph.D. in Immunology and Infectious Diseases from the Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health. Prior to assuming command of USAMRID in June 2005, Colonel Korch served as director of the Medical, Chemical, and Biological Defense Research Division for the Defense Threat Reduction Agency at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. He previously served as director of National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures at the center there under the Department of Homeland Security at Fort Detrick. And his overseas assignments include tours of duty in Kuwait and the Republic of Korea. And he served as Biodefense Technical Science Officer for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs at the Pentagon. Colonel Korch is no stranger to USAMRID, having held a number of positions here over his 20-year military career, including Research Entomologist, Virology Division Chief, and Deputy Commander. Now, while the primary mission of USAMRID and its sister component, USAMRISID, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Chemical Defense at Aberdeen Proving Ground near Baltimore, is to support the military, USAMRID and USAMRISID do offer training and support to first responders and first receivers. And those two areas are what we're going to discuss today. Colonel, it's good to see you again, and thanks very much for hosting us.
It's a pleasure, John.
In this first segment, we're going to talk about a little background of the two commands and an overview of training. So let's start with the 101 and brief history of USAMRID. What happens here at Fort Detrick?
Well, USAMRID's core mission is conducting basic and applied research on biological threats, resulting in medical solutions for our warfighters. So we develop vaccines, diagnostics, therapeutics, and information to protect U.S. troops from biological warfare threats and from naturally occurring infectious diseases. USAMRID is also the lead medical research laboratory for the U.S. Biological Defense Research Program, and it's the only laboratory in the Department of Defense equipped to study highly hazardous viruses at biosafety level 4, or maximum containment. We serve as the test and evaluation center or translational research for biodefense vaccines and therapeutics that are developed by other agencies and by ourselves in conducting this type of research.
Now, we obviously have a lot of first responders and first receivers who are members of our service. And I think these folks would be interested to know the range of support and services that you provide for those two communities.
Well, first of all, USAMRID is a national reference laboratory for the Lab Response Network, and that's established by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. This network is charged with maintaining an integrated system of state, local public health, federal, military, and international laboratories that can respond to bioterrorism, chemical terrorism, other public health emergencies. And as part of that network, USAMRID was integral in co-developing diagnostic materials like that to use for bacillus anthracis or the anthrax gamophage phage assay, which was approved by FDA last year, as well as other bacillus anthracis diagnostic reagents. While we also are assisting the Department of Homeland Security with evaluating commercial off-the-shelf diagnostic solutions for first responders. In 2004, we participated in multi-center evaluations involving several commercial handheld assays for anthrax. This year, they plan to evaluate the handheld assays for ricin toxins as well. In addition, we have fielded, we have hosted field visits from the National Fire Academy in Abbotsburg, Maryland, those folks who teach the first responders. That's been an informal process thus far, but for the next year, field visits are planned for each of the two-week courses that they sponsor on advanced life support response to hazardous material incidents. Finally, we conduct a variety of training courses aimed at increasing recognition of biological threat agents and available medical countermeasures.
It's interesting that you've got the field visits from the National Fire Academy. We were up there with Dennis O'Neill earlier this summer and had a wonderful chance to familiarize ourselves with that that site. Okay, let's talk about that training. How many courses do you offer, and how many times a year do you offer them? How long's the typical course, and how many students attend each one?
Wow, a bunch of questions there. Yeah. Okay, there are a total of four courses. The Medical Management of Chemical and Biological Casualties course, also known to us as the MCBC course, is a six-day program, 3 days of which are held here at Fort Detrick and are dedicated to biological agents and biodefense. Chemical agents and chemical defense encompass the other 3 days of the course, and they're covered at our sister laboratory, USA MRICD. We just call it ICD, at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. The focus of the MCBC course is to provide graduate-level medical education about chemical and biological warfare agents and medical countermeasures to physicians, physician assistants, nurses, and other healthcare providers. This course runs four times a year, and we can accept up to 150 students per offering. The Field Management of Chemical and Biological Casualties course, or the FCBC, is a five-day course conducted entirely at MRICD. This course is designed for medics, corpsmen, and other first responders, first receivers, and it focuses on field evaluation, decontamination, and new interventions for casualties exposed to a chemical or biological warfare agent. This course is offered five times a year, and it can accept up to 150 students. Now, one of the newer courses we've been actively involved with is the Hospital Management of Chemical, Biological, Radiological, Nuclear, and High Explosive Incidents course, known as HMC Burney. This is a five-day course. It's hosted at Aberdeen Proving Ground, and it's designed for emergency managers, medical operations officers, hospital staff, and those involved in management of response to a C. Burney event. The schedule for this course is variable, with between 2 to 5 courses a year, depending largely on demand. So those three courses are focused on medical providers. But we also host a laboratory course here at USAMRID through our Diagnostic Systems Division, and that's called the Field Identification of Biological Warfare Agents, or FIBWA. The full FIBWA course lasts 20 working days, so about 4 weeks, and contains a field situational training exercise that provides an opportunity to integrate laboratory training with real-world scenarios to challenge the students' understanding and skills. This course is offered twice a year, and we are unfortunately limited to 8 participants in each class. A condensed version of this course, called the FIBWA Managers Course, is a 3-day program, and it's designed to introduce leaders to management of biological warfare agent identification, with an emphasis on laboratory operations and understanding assay use and assay limitations. We run this 4 times a year, and it can accommodate 8 students per class. Finally, we teach a FIBWA course geared for the National Guard Civil Support Teams, or the CSTs. That is a 3-week course, and it's offered 7 times per year. We can train 8 students in each session. Both the full FIBWA course and the FIBWA CST course are certified. They're certified for undergraduate and graduate level education through a partnership that we have between us here at USAMRID and the James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Now, these first responders and first receivers who are eligible to attend, how do you select these folks for the non-military slots in your courses?
Well, the medical courses are designed primarily for military personnel, but civilians are able to attend. Government-employed civilian personnel can submit a Department of Defense Form 1556 through their chain of command for approval, and then send to the respective civilian personnel office training sections their paperwork. Civilians are not employed by the federal government can submit a written request including name, social security number, home address, phone number, email address, job description, job title, course dates requested, and a point of contact to our registration office. Now, if accepted, you'll be notified within 30 days of the course start date, and you'll receive an information package via email. So, there is a registration for all civilian students who do not work for the Department of the Army, and it's $900 for the MCBC course and the HMC Burney course, and I believe $500 for the FCBC course. Hmm. By nature of the subject matter, the FIBWIC course attendees tend to either be active duty military or National Guard personnel with a real direct need for these skills and knowledge. So we haven't established a formal mechanism for civilians to attend this course yet. We have had discussions with James Madison University on developing a similar course for civilians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, some of the courses you offer is at Aberdeen at the ICD. Now, that's purely on the chemical side, correct?
Yes. The MCBC students are split into two groups of 75 students. One group attends the 3 days of bio training here at USAMRID, while the other group attends 3 days of chemical training at the ICD. At the end of the third day, the two groups switch locations and receive the additional training at the respective institutes. The FCBC is hosted entirely at ICD, and we conduct about a half day of biological training in that course, mainly focused on giving first responders the tools to recognize diseases that result from biological warfare agents.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also one course you offer at the Armed Forces Radiobiological Biology Research Institute. That's AFRI?
Right, at AFRI. The Hospital Management Suburney course, is also hosted at ICD, but it's a coordinated effort between our lab, USAMRID, the Institute of Chemical Defense, and AFRI to cover the C. Burney incident management collectively.
Now, do you have any other partners?
We've partnered with other organizations and agencies in the past to provide advanced medical training. For example, we partnered with the CDC and the FDA for a series of satellite broadcasts, and I can talk about those a little bit more in a moment.
Okay, well, let's look at field management of chemical biological casualties. And this is the first specific course. I'd like to know what are folks going to actually learn in the details there?
Well, the FCBC course covers the current global threats of chemical and biological agent use, characteristics and effects of these agents, recognition and emergency treatment of agent exposures, principles of triage and decontamination of chemical and biological agent casualties.
Mm-hmm. Now, this involves classroom, lab, and field training, right?
A combination of classroom instruction and small group exercises. It reinforces these casualty management principles. In the laboratory, attendees gain a valuable hands-on experience by participating in the resuscitation of a lab animal exposed to nerve agent simulant. And during 2 days of field training, attendees establish a casualty decontamination site and use the site during scenario-based exercises to manage litter and ambulatory casualties. Using this site, attendees practice principles of personal protection, agent detection, triage, emergency treatment, and decontamination of casualties.
Now, who's been taking this course? Have you had CST members, for example?
This course has been well attended by military first responders, first receivers, as well as non-medical personnel involved in C. Burney response. Mm. The Weapons of Mass Destruction civil support teams do, in fact, attend this training. We've also had a number of civilian emergency medical system personnel and civilian rapid response teams attend the course, in addition to other military personnel involved with other consequence management missions.
Well, in this next segment, I want to talk about the medical management of chemical and biological casualties course. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The focus here is on those medical providers who are likely to be involved in the diagnosis and treatment of chemical and biological casualties in the medical facilities as opposed to exposure sites in the field. So there is more emphasis on the diseases resulting from exposure to biological agents. Biological portion of the course, again, 3 days long. It goes into detail on the pathophysiology, clinical presentation, clinical diagnostics, treatment, and prophylaxis of biological agents, including but not limited to anthrax, smallpox, and botulinum toxins. Well, we tour USAMRID in our patient containment care suite, receive an overview of the diagnostic equipment used in the FIBWA course, and we review case studies. The chemical portion of the course discusses chemical agents and contains a one-day exercise to provide and practice the principles of personal protection, triage, treatment, decontamination of chemical casualties. During this exercise, attendees, of course, learn the capabilities and limitations of the mission-oriented protective posture or MOP gear when treating casualties in a contaminated environment.
Now, this course would be good for first responders, first receivers, and the private sector in public health, I guess.
Well, MCBC was designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we've had several first responders and even non-medical personnel attend the course recently. This is excellent training for public health providers. We frequently have students from the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service in the course.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that the students get Category 1 credit towards the AMA's PRA Category 1 credits. That's pretty significant, right?
Right. MCBC, FCBC, and the Hospital Management CBRNE, they're all approved for continuing medical educational credits and CEUs. And the MCBC is approved for 46 Category 1 credits.
Mm-hmm. Colonel, what are the distance learning products for this course?
Well, USAMRID produced a series of live satellite broadcasts from 1999 to 2001, and these are available on VHS through a course website. In 2003, we completed a series of two-hour telecasts on specific topics, including smallpox, recognition and response, vaccines against biological warfare agents, and toxins as biological warfare and terrorism agents. Those are also available through the website on VHS and on DVD.
Uh-huh. Now, are there plans to offer any other distance learning products?
Yes. In fact, we just aired on September 20th of this year a two-hour telecast on botulism that focuses on clinical diagnosis, management, and public health aspects of this threat. The program will be rebroadcast as a satellite, VTC, and web broadcast on October 25th, I think from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's been approved for continuing medical education through Swank Health. And people can register and view this broadcast at the Swank Health website.
In this next section, I'd like to talk a little bit about your hospital management of a CBRNE incidents course that you have at both ICD and USAMRID, and I guess at the AFRI. Now, my understanding is this is for hospital-based medical professionals. Do you have students from public health, the private sector, and civilians?
Well, HMCBRNE course has been a mix of active duty, reservists, and civilians. Overall, about 50% have been civilians. Several have emergency management experience that they relate, actually, during the course.
Now, my understanding also is the course involves classroom instruction scenarios and tabletop exercises. Can you tell us about what's involved?
Sure. The MCBC and FCBC are geared for medical providers. A missing element has been information for emergency managers on how to handle incidents and for hospital administrators on how to manage healthcare facilities during CBRNE mass casualty events. So this course is designed to fill that gap.
Mm-hmm.
During the bio day, there's less focus on the agents themselves and more focus on infection control issues, handling large numbers of infected casualties, and large-scale distribution of prophylaxis and vaccination materials. ICD spends a day on similar issues regarding the chemical agents, and AFRI follows suits with the radiological and nuclear perspective. The goal is to get attendees to think about the requirements needed now so they can plan accordingly and to devise methods to leverage assets from the local community, from the region, or from the state. Case scenarios are used to review points and to allow the students to give perspectives on how the situation would be handled in their jurisdiction so that comparisons can be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Course ends with a tabletop exercise.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does what you teach tally with JCO compliance?
Well, there's a brief review of the National Incident Management System, or the NIMS, and the National Response Plan. We can also cover the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, or JACO, Environment of Care Standards, including requirements concerning hospital roles in responding to terrorist incidents. The information in the course can be brought back to the student's organization and incorporated into their disaster response plans using an all-hazards approach.
Mm-hmm. Now, here you offer the CME and CEU and CEH credits, right?
Yes. It's been approved for 30 AMA Category 1 credits.
Okay, now in this segment, tell us a little bit more about the field identification of biowarfare agents, that course. It's a DOD course, is it not? And who else can participate?
Well, it's geared towards those who would be involved in biological agent identification. The primary users have been military personnel and members of the National Guard civil support teams.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the training is on a deployable confirmatory lab under field conditions.
Yes, that's right. Both the full four-week FIBWA course and the manager's course involves hands-on field laboratory training.
Now, within this course is a manager's course and a train-the-trainer and a special interest train-the-trainer course. Tell us about those.
Okay. The manager's course is designed for lab managers so they can understand and interpret the data coming from the lab and put it into the proper context. For example, understanding false negatives and false positives. They do become familiar with the equipment and the techniques, but it's not as intensive as the full FIBWA course. As for train the trainer, these tend to be special courses with a focus on training people who will be responsible for further training of other personnel. They're usually specific to a particular technique or a particular piece of equipment.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you teach on the operational issues for decision making?
Well, there's a large amount of knowledge necessary for the detection of biological threat agents. False negatives and false positives, sensitivity, proper sample handling, testing strategies for different sample types, all of these play into the decision-making for operational calls.
Now, how about setting up and operating a lab in the field?
Yep, the full FIBWA course teaches students to set up, maintain, and operate a deployable laboratory under field conditions. This four-week hands-on course offers training in the most advanced field technologies for confirmatory identification of biological threat agents. It was developed here at USAMRIID, and it's the only course of its kind in the Department of Defense.
Mm.
Now, FIBWA grew out of a need for battlefield detection of BW agents. As field detectors were developed and deployed, the ability to confirm what the detectors were seeing was crucial to add confidence for battlefield, medical, and national command authority decisions. To ensure that the training stays on the cutting edge, concepts of operation and diagnostic materials, equipment, and technology are continually evaluated and transitioned into the field.
Well, in this segment, I'd like to talk about the bioagent detection technologies that you have here. Our discussion of this field identification course leads me to ask about those thoughts on the detection technologies. We've come a long way since I first started looking into the field back in 1998. What do you find that's on the cutting edge in terms of detection technologies development, and where are we now in terms of turnaround times in the analytical process?
Well, the current technology is still maturing. The two primary rapid techniques we use are polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, and electrochemiluminescence, or ECL. Both can be used in the field, but with some limitations, and the reagents and the procedures are actually still being refined. Now, microarrays hold promise, but are not yet mature enough for deployment. We're probably a few years away from field use on those. You asked about turnaround time, and the turnaround time for diagnostics is still measured in hours. For example, we need 6 to 8 hours total for a PCR sample processing and analysis, even though the PCR process itself only takes about 45 minutes. Immunoassays based on ECL are quicker, but only now approaching the level of sensitivity that PCR is known for. Culture is still the gold standard, but it's difficult to do properly in the field. For toxins, immunoassay works well, but for some toxins, we need additional testing, like mouse testing, that's still needed to give a definitive result.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to the today, you folks train on PCR and immunoabsorbent assays. What others?
We use immunohistochemistry for working with tissues and ELISA, or enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays for serological diagnosis. Conventional PCR assays are used for some biological agents and are not yet available for real-time analysis, but we're working towards their development. Mm-hmm. We also train routine microbiological culture and identification.
Well, tell us about the various approaches to detecting bioagents in the unknown samples. You emphasize nucleic acid-based assays, extraction, and PCR. Are those the best in terms of broad capabilities and the operational practicalities and the cost?
High-confidence detection of bioagents requires a truly integrated sample analysis approach. Through the use of these multiple technologies and multiple independent biomarkers, a high-confidence answer can usually be obtained. So this approach is critical in reducing false positive results. Integrated diagnostics include the use of medical intelligence, clinical diagnosis, classical microbiology, immunodiagnostics, and the rapid nucleic acid analysis that I just described. The current focus is on pushing the immunodiagnostics, the ECL, and the rapid nucleic acid or real-time PCR analysis as far forward as possible, identifying next-generation technologies that could integrate molecular and immunological detection, as well as technologies that can identify any and all organisms in an unknown sample.
Well, tell us about the multimedia DNA extraction protocols that you train on.
The focus is on clinical samples, such as whole blood, nasal swabs, serum, sputum, so forth. Last year, we performed a comparison of manual extraction methods for the JBAIDS program, which is the Joint Biological Agent Identification and Diagnostic System. We demonstrated that lower sample volumes could be used without compromising sensitivity. The study eliminated the need for those large benchtop centrifuges and therefore reduces the footprint for deployed capability. We're currently engaged in a tri-service, multi-center trial of small automated sample extraction equipment and instruments. And mm-hmm. The study involves the Air Force Research Laboratory, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and the Naval Medical Research Center and USAMRID. And it will provide an automated solution, we expect, to sample extraction for the JBAIDS program.
Mm-hmm. So given all of that, what technologies would you advise for the state and local guys and gals in the field? I'm speaking of the folks who really don't have the resources that you do.
Well, the simplest and best advice I can give is to handle the samples properly, to forward them to one of the Laboratory Response Network partner labs for analysis. The LRN is an extremely valuable resource for them here at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this last segment, I want to talk a little bit about your aeromedical isolation team. You have two of them, I think, and they operate with C-130s, don't they?
Yes, correct. USAMRID maintains two aeromedical isolation teams, which are the MedCom Smart Teams, or Special Medical Augmentation Response Teams. Each team has a physical, a physician, medical director, a nurse, has six medics, a lab tech, and a veterinary tech. AIT was originally developed to give USAMRID the capability to extract our researchers in the field in the event they became ill from a highly contagious agent. It's now a patient containment care platform that the DOD can use to evacuate highly contagious casualties. The teams are designed to deploy anywhere in the world on Air Force assets, and they can use a number of different airframes, including the C-130, the C-141, and the C-17. They can also use the CH-47 as a rotary wing form of transportation.
Well, now, the main threat here is the viral hemorrhagic fevers. Would you list them for us and tell us if you envisage using the teams for other bio threats on the horizon?
Well, viral hemorrhagic fevers are a group of RNA viruses. They belong to one of any four distinct families. There's the arenaviruses, filoviruses, the Bunya viruses and the flaviviruses. Ebola virus, Marburg virus, and Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever virus are some examples and are probably the most recognized. But there are over a dozen distinct viruses in this group. While we've prepared to transport patients with these infections, our procedures and equipment will allow us to safely transport patients with unidentified emerging or reemerging diseases that are highly contagious or transmitted by the aerosol route.
Well, now tell us about how you've equipped the team. The key components are isolating the patient and protecting the caregivers. So I guess this means you have, you have a plastic isolator and protective suits. Can you give us the specs for each?
Yes, the patient isolators are made of a clear PVC with an airflow intake and an exhaust, and the exhaust is HEPA filtered. There are three different versions of the isolators that we use. The stretcher transport isolator, or the STI, is the smallest, and it can be mounted on a standard NATO litter. It's a battery pack that can last for about 6 hours and allows it to be moved to the site of patient pickup. The aircraft transport isolator, or the ATI, is larger, and it's designed for use onboard the aircraft by plugging it into the aircraft's electrical systems. The last isolator is the laboratory benchtop isolator, which is not used for patient care, but may be deployed so that laboratory studies can be conducted in the field under biosafety level 4 conditions. Now, while putting the patients in isolation, our team wears Tyvek suits with powered air purifying respirators.
Well, now, what about communications among the caregivers and communications with the patient, or at least monitoring his or her vital signs? What do you use there?
That's a good question. The physical examination techniques are very difficult, as you can imagine, to perform in the isolator. Now, we can't insert and remove the stethoscope to listen to heart sounds or breathing sounds, but we are capable of placing monitoring cables through a port that has a sealed prior to picking up the patient. This gives us a capability to monitor heart rate, pulse oxygenation, blood pressure, cardiac rhythm, and temperature. And you're right, communication with the patient can be challenging. Not only is there a plastic layer between you and the patient, there's also the noise created by the isolator's motor that's producing that negative pressure airflow. The most important part is when the patient is in the isolator and the team is in personal protective equipment because of the noise from the respirators. This makes it very difficult to communicate with the patient, but also with the other team members as the patient is being moved into the isolator.
Now, what do you have to say about using internal communication systems inside the suit? I think you see that as a better way to go than using the external models, right?
Yes, we've put on digital wireless communication systems. We do that prior to donning our personal protective equipment. The system we use, it offers several advantages, such as the use of a throat microphone so we can have hands-free communication. And since it's inside our personal protective equipment, we don't have to worry about contamination of that equipment.
Well, maintaining containment is a priority, and, for example, I understand in moving the patient, you use a plastic sleeve to transfer the patient to the intensive care suite. Now, walk us through the process from the moment you come upon the patient to delivery to the suite. You know, what are the protocols and what's the equipment?
Well, in most cases, the team would deploy to an airfield by ground transportation. They would load onto an aircraft and then fly to the pickup location. The team would then take the STI to a location near the patient. They don our personal protective equipment, then move to the patient location and place them into the STI. We'd move the STI out and decontaminate the outside of it. Near the aircraft, we move the patient from the STI to the ATI using this plastic sleeve that you talked about that connects the isolators between the two isolators so we don't break containment of the patient. The ATI is located onto the aircraft, and we fly back to a designated airfield, and then we can transport the ATI to USAMRID either by ground transportation or by rotary wing aircraft. Once here, another plastic sleeve is used to connect the ATI to our special containment care suite, and the patient is transferred into the suite through a special portal.
Now, you've never transported a patient to USAMRIID, but you did assist in the Ebola Reston outbreak in 1990. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. A commercial laboratory in Reston, Virginia, called USAMRIID scientists for help with, at that time, a mysterious disease that was killing primates imported for use in biomedical research. USAMRIID investigator isolated an Ebola-like virus, and a USAMRIID team directed the decontamination of the laboratory. There was no spread to laboratory personnel, to local residents, or to the environment. The diagnostic assay developed at USAMRIID for the disease has come to be called Ebola Reston, and it's been made available commercially for use in screening primates imported into the United States. During the same year, a university hospital in Sweden requested USAMRIID's expertise in diagnosis and treatment of a patient recently returned from Africa who was thought to have Ebola hemorrhagic fever. Because the patient was in shock and near death and could not be moved, the USAMRIID medical team flew to Sweden with a portable patient isolation equipment and trained the hospital staff in high containment patient care within 24 hours of their request.
Wow. Well, you also deployed the portable benchtop isolator to the Bronx Zoo in 1999 to collect samples. Did that turn out to be part of the diagnosis of the first American cases of the West Nile virus?
Well, amongst the first, not the first, but yes, USAMRIID scientists were among the first to help link these bird deaths among wild crows as well as exotic birds in the Bronx Zoo with the human cases of disease. This was largely done, though, by the veterinary pathologist there at the Bronx Zoo at the time. USAMRIID entomologists conducted critical vector competence studies to determine which species of mosquito here in the United States were responsible or could transmit the virus by bite. And we deployed the laboratory benchtop isolator and other specialized equipment to the Bronx Zoo to enable safe collection of samples there.
Wow. Well, George, this has been most comprehensive. I really appreciate the time you've given us. Great seeing you again, and all the very, very best. And thank you so much for your service to our country.
And thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thanks, George.